Hi, folks. Welcome to the View 902 podcast. My name is Paul Kimball, and my guest today is a young filmmaker from here in Halifax, Nova Scotia, although he's originally from the South Shore. I like to think of him as the Anakin to my Obi-Wan. And while I know that didn't end up very well for either one of them, he's like a son to me, although perhaps one that I might disinherit someday. Anyhow, welcome to the View 902 podcast, Dylan Garland.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
We should probably get into some serious, deep things about the film industry in Nova Scotia, about your career, about the films you've done, about where everything's going. But it is Sunday, December
18th.
Sunday, December 18th, and tonight, because you and I, and we're going to admit it here, I have no problem doing this, even though it'll probably kill my political career. I'm a huge wrestling fan, like massive wrestling fan, and so are you.
Yes.
We bonded over wrestling and Star Wars very early on in our knowing each other. So tonight it is WWE Roadblock, which is the Liechtenstein of WWE pay-per-views, which is to say it's the one that nobody really knows about. I have to ask you, big match tonight, Roman Reigns, Canada's own Kevin Owens, who do you got?
I have to go with my fellow Canadian, Kevin Owens. I don't think it'll be clean. I think someone's going to get involved, perhaps one of the greatest Canadians of all time, Chris Jericho. He might get involved, but I can't imagine Roman, especially with WWE the way it is now, going into 2017 with Roman holding both belts. So I could be wrong. I hope I'm not, but I got to go with Owens.
I have to say, I do not understand why the WWE keep shoving Roman Reigns the face down the audience's throat, because somewhere in the back, somebody, all of them, I would think, must go, everybody's booing, that's not good. And if you're Roman Reigns, and folks, let's all spare a moment here of sympathy for poor Roman, because here's a guy who's just, he's just doing his job, he's just doing what they tell him to do, he's trying to be a face, and he gets booed out of the buildings. You were at WrestleMania, what was it, a year or two ago?
2014, WrestleMania 30.
And who was he? Who was he wrestling at WrestleMania 30?
He was still in the Shield. He actually had a very quick throwaway match with the New Age Outlaws. I was kind of disappointed because it was about a two-minute match. But the Raw after WrestleMania, which I was at, was the official face turn of the Shield. So I saw when Roman finally speared Triple H, and we were going ballistic. Everybody was pumped. So it's a bizarre turn, thinking back then, being in a crowd of, 20,000 people cheering for Roman Reigns, to just audibly hearing Vince McMahon turn down the audience now.
Could you find 20,000 people in the United States right now that would cheer for Roman Reigns? I don't know. You probably could.
I don't know. I think it's like it's almost become fun for the fans to boo him, because a lot of fans, they seem like they're having a good time with Roman. It's become almost part of his character. And I guarantee you, when he turns heel, they're going to cheer. So it's a bizarre world.
I sort of view WWE audiences now, live audiences, like rogue waves. I'm fascinated by rogue waves on the ocean. Your ship could be going along and suddenly this 80-foot wave or 60-foot wave or whatever could tip your ship over. And in what I like to call my Bill Clinton pivot, you've seen Rogue One. So no spoilers.
Yep.
I haven't seen it. I don't want to hear a thing about it other than I'm going to ask you, compare how you felt to seeing Rogue One to how you felt to seeing The Force Awakens.
Funny you asked that, because I thought about it immediately when I left the theater, because it was such a different experience. I went into Rogue One not as excited for Rogue One as I was for Force Awakens, because I just thought, episodically, we have all these things confirmed. I really liked Rey leading up to the film, and I was just super excited. Rogue One, you know where the story's going, so it's exciting, but it wasn't as exciting as Seven to me. I was so wrong. I was incredibly wrong. I came out of that theater loving A New Hope even more, A New Hope being my favorite movie of all time. And I almost feel guilty for not being as excited as I should have been for Rogue One. The ending 10 minutes of that film changes, and I won't say who, but changes one of the most pivotal characters in the series in a very good way by presenting it in a very bad way. And I'll leave it at that. But it is amazing.
First of all, it better not be Jar Jar Binks.
Hey, no spoilers, right?
Please tell me there's no Jar Jar Binks.
There's none that I could tell.
You can spoil that one for me. That would be, I'm perfectly happy to have that one spoiled. By the way, I'm a little hurt that you consider New Hope your favorite film. Personally, I always thought it was Eternal Kiss.
Well, I mean, Hollywood films. Eternal Kiss is always at the top of my chain of everything else, but, you know, I got to separate the two.
Eternal Kiss could be a Hollywood film if I drove down to Los Angeles and dropped a DVD off under the Hollywood sign. That's as close as it's ever going to get to being a Hollywood film. Do you realize, and this is my way of leading also into your film career, that you are the only person who has ever worked on all four of my feature films, The Three Good Ones and Eternal Kiss?
I didn't realize that.
And this is how I met Dylan, folks. What were you, 16 years old back in 2008?
I must have been 16 or 15.
So his mother, she convinced the crazy homicidal criminal Americans who were running the Shelburne soundstage back then, Jim Kendrick and Mary Barstow, if you're listening, you know, hopefully the sound of my voice makes your heads explode. And people, you know, you probably think I'm going to take that part out, Dylan. No, that part's staying in. Dylan's mom, I guess your mom convinced or knew Jim Kendrick or Mary, one of these two crazy Americans who ran the studio, the soundstage. And so that one day you just showed up and Kendrick came over to me in one of his lucid, non-homicidal moments, said, hey, there's this young kid, you know, do you mind if he shadows you for a couple of days? I think you were there for a few days. And I said, yeah, no, sure, absolutely. I've taken interns from high schools and all sorts of things during my career. So, yeah, I'd like to say that's how you began your career, but I know, Dukes of Haggard, that that's not how you began your career. But you are the only person who's ever been on location, on set with me in all four of the feature films that I've ever shot.
Wow.
Not even my own brother, because he took a pass on Eternal Kiss. So you're it.
Wow. Well, it's funny, the Jim and Mary thing. When I made the Dukes of Haggard, they were just buying the soundstage in Shelburne, and it was a big deal. Everybody thought they were, you know, the biggest thing to come out of anywhere. And Mom invited them to the Dukes of Haggard premiere, and that's how I met them. And they invited me up to basically do labor work for them. And then it just so happened that you had a film up there, and that's kind of how it all happened. So I can thank I don't thank this thing in at all, ever. I actually pretend it doesn't exist, but I have to thank Dukes of Haggard for that, setting that all up.
I don't know why you don't come to your peace with Dukes of Haggard the way I have with Eternal Kiss. Because Dukes of Haggard, frankly, is better than Eternal Kiss. If you put me in a room and said, you have to watch one of these two things, I easily choose Dukes of Haggard. In fact, I choose Dukes of Haggard over half the stuff I see on Netflix. It was a terrible film I started watching last night called Traitors or Trading or something. Traded. With Michael Perry and Chris Christopherson, I thought, oh, your careers have driven off into a ditch and then been eaten by an alligator while being beset upon by poisonous warthogs or something. You began, we're still on the Shelburne thing, so you're originally from the South Shore, and I can never remember, you're from Clark's Harbor, you're from Barrington, whereabouts?
My answer to that is yes. I moved around quite a bit. I was born in Shelburne, but basically the entire Shelburne County area, I've lived in every little spot. So Woods Harbor, Clark's Harbor, Barrington. So just if anybody asked, it's Shelburne County is my hometown.
This is the point where I just kind of let you take over for a little while. So what I'm going to say is, how does a young boy from Shelburne, Nova Scotia, and I mean, no slight on Shelburne, wind up in Halifax as an multi-award winning music video director? You have made your own feature film. You've directed a number of short films, including at least one I know of that won an award. Actually, I was looking at it earlier today. Your resume looks better than mine. Because it doesn't have Eternal Kiss on it.
Yes, I think it does, though. Yeah, it does.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, okay. You might want to change that. Give us the Dylan Garland story in 5 minutes.
All right. So it officially happened, I want to say, like physically, me actually picking up a camera at one night at Pondhook Campground near Liverpool. A bunch of my friends, you know, I was hanging out with, they were all about a year older than me. So I was the young one in the crowd, and they were all, and this is such a bizarre start to the story, but they were all going to watch Jackass the movie, the 2002 hit. And not knowing what it was, I just wanted to hang out with them. So I convinced Mom. I said, can I just go watch? I know it's bad, but is it okay if I go? And her exact words were, yes, you can go watch. Just promise me you'll never try and do what they do in that movie. Sorry, Mom. And I went and I watched this movie and it enamored me. I don't know what about it was, but I just said, oh, I got to start filming stuff. So Mom had this big bulky camera. And the next day, not listening to her words of wisdom to not do it, I just picked up a camera and we went water skiing. We did skits. We did all this stuff that just has never seen the light of day. And the more I did it over the next couple of years, the more I started loving the whole craft of it. So we went out and made basically a Jackass. I don't want to call it a parody. It's a ripoff by every stretch of the imagination. And we put out this movie, and people were entertained. And I think that's where I got just the inkling of, okay, I'm kind of addicted to this. Making something and seeing a whole group of people laugh and enjoy themselves. There's something here that I've never felt like this about anything. So after the Dukes of Hagrid, we kind of strayed away from it because I wanted to get into more scripted stuff. And I started remembering that this wasn't necessarily starting with Jackass. This actually started years ago with Star Wars, ironically. Star Wars and Jurassic Park. Because Mom used to tell me, and she's told me this recently too, is that when I was a kid watching Jurassic Park, instead of like just watching and being like, oh my God, a dinosaur, I would turn to her and ask, how do they do that? Like, how is that on screen? I don't understand. How do they make the T-Rex? And with Star Wars, we'd watch it over and over and over again and just enjoy it. And I love the adventure and just the entertainment of it. It's just fun. So when I left high school, I went to the Center for Arts Technology, which is now the Da Vinci College of Art and Design in Halifax. And that's where basically I just learned, you know, the very basics of what I needed to know. And Thor Hendrickson was my teacher, and he was fantastic in not only understanding that it's not all academic, but also understanding that there's an art form to it. There's a way to go about things. And he also allowed me the freedom to just try new stuff. And, you know, not holding back, I got pretty frustrated with how the school was going, because I was paying a lot of money for classes that I felt were just an incredible waste of time and money. We actually budgeted it out once and figured out how much every class costs, and it was just ridiculous. So I got frustrated, and I said, you know what, never mind. I'm just going to use the gear that we have, that I have access to, and I'm going to go make whatever I want to make. I'm going to go do music videos. I'm going to go do whatever I want to do, because I was frustrated. And I ended up working for Dalhousie on a couple of music videos. One that was about the student tuition cap coming off in 2011, and everybody was mad about it, so we made a music video about it, and it actually gained like 50,000 hits very quickly, and it was nuts. So from that, I managed to basically meet a lot of different people, one of them being the Town Heroes, who I've done music videos for since late 2011, I think it was. And then from there, I just did more music videos. I was kind of seeing what I wanted to do as a director and stuff. And luckily, through music videos being the main thing, I managed to get 2 East Coast Music Awards, 1 Nova Scotia Music Award. And it was just a good motivator to kind of keep going at it. In 2014, I decided to finally bite the bullet and say, I want to make a feature film. And that was Afraid to Speak, which is a film about depression. And yeah, I mean, the short version of it is I think I got bored with my own, what was possible in my hometown. And I don't mean that as a slight on anybody down there. I'm just not a fisherman or anything like that. I have the highest respect for them. My whole family's fishermen and all that. I just, whenever I was doing something not related to movie making or storytelling, I just got so, I don't want to say frustrated, but just very anxious to go be doing that. So I decided, you know what? Well, why not? I'm going to pick up a camera. I'm going to go learn how to do it. And then I'm going to try and find my voice in that. And yeah, stubbornness and all that kind of led me to be in Halifax. And it's worked out pretty far.
It's kind of like the Luke Skywalker thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with being Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru running the moisture farm on Tatooine. It's a good life, and they were good to Luke, but Luke would look in the sky and he'd want to go somewhere else and dream. And not everybody's a dreamer, for whether they can dream or want to dream, and some people don't have the opportunity to dream, frankly. But you did. So here you are in Halifax, and I want to talk about Afraid to Speak, and I also want to talk about your music videos. But before we get to those things, I do want to ask you about something you just said, which is, you know, here you are in Halifax and things are going well so far. You've done all this work, you've made your own films, you've worked for me and others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're going to be director of photography on my new television series that we're both doing for Ron Foley McDonald's company, Winterlight, called Haunted. But here's the thing. Haunted is funded by the Nova Scotia Film and Television Investment Fund that's administered now by Nova Scotia Business Incorporated. It's the fund that the McNeil government set up after they blew the film industry up in 2015. After consulting with Screen Nova Scotia, they worked up this new fund. Okay, that's fine. From then until now, and this is an article that I wrote on View902 just this past week. The great thing about NSBI, by the way, is all the numbers are transparent now. The Liberals were right about that. Not all the numbers in the old days were completely transparent. So now they are. So you can go on. I'm surprised nobody had done this, actually. But I collated all the numbers, brought them together, and I said, great, how much money have they spent? $17 million, roughly. How much of that, and I'll target this to you specifically. I looked and I asked how much has gone to minorities, and if I was interviewing Corey Bowles, I'd ask him about that, and how much has gone to women who control companies, and if I was interviewing Chelsea or somebody like that, Chelsea Camo, I would talk to her about that. But because I have you here, I took a look at another statistic. Of the $17 million, 0.83%, or $141,416, have gone to companies controlled by people that you could classify as new voices in the Nova Scotia film and television industry. So there you go, Dylan. Less than 1% of the money that has been given out under the new fund goes to people, let's say, like you. New voices, up-and-comers. When you say things are going well in Halifax, how does that statistic make you feel when you look a year or 2 years or 5 years or even 10 years down the road about the opportunities that you might have or might not have and whether or not you might be able to stay and build your career here as opposed to going somewhere else?
Yeah, and I mean, when I say things are going well, I mean, in the context of, like you kind of mentioned before, I'm 24 and my resume is pretty packed. And in that context, I feel like I've done well. So that's kind of what I meant by that. Now, in regards to that, I mean, I'm increasingly getting frustrated with how the entire thing is being presented in some ways as this big successful change by certain people. I mean, the one thing that this city needs, and I mean that as an outsider, because you and me both have had this conversation. I mean, I haven't necessarily been, you know, invited to every industry party in this town yet. I have been, you know, rejected many a time. But the one thing I can see is this town needs very specifically growth and, you know, support for its younger filmmakers. I mean, if you're not going to put in the effort and allow these young filmmakers to have access to something that can help them with storytelling, that doesn't want to remove them from the city and have to go to Toronto or LA or anywhere. I mean, there's not that much there. We lost the My First Feature Fund, which was a big loss for a lot of directors here who wanted to kind of, you know, sharpen their teeth and get that going. And I'm having a hard time getting a straight answer from anybody in which, okay, I have a feature film that I want to make. How would I go about, you know, starting that process here? And I don't think anybody knows that with a filmmaker on my level. So, I mean, if something doesn't change in some sort of, you know, conversation becomes a little louder. It, just from me personally, I can't speak for the others, but it's increasingly frustrating because I want to make movies here. There are so many stories that I've written that I kind of have, you know, ready for a development stage that I could picture here. I could picture down home in Barrington or Shelburne, but I have absolutely no idea how to even begin the process of making that a possibility. So it's frustrating in a one word answer. I mean, it's just frustrating because you put so much time here and you work your butt off here to, you know, help the industry as much as you can and make your own stories. But then it's almost like they just say, oh, here's a wall. Have fun. Here's a toothpick. Try and break through. So I don't know. It's frustrating. It's just in a cloud of unknown for me, at least at the moment.
You know, there's always going to be established companies. There clearly is in the United States. I mean, obviously, there's established companies, and that's not a bad thing. When the Film Development Corporation was begun 20 years ago, and I began my career working there, there were people that we wanted to see succeed, and we helped them build their companies. And the 8 people that were on my list, 7 of them, I think, or 6 of them, were significant producers 20 years ago, and they're still there. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. If you look at the numbers, though, folks, and I'll put a link here in the write-up for this interview, you'll see that while there's nothing inherently wrong with older companies doing well, there's probably something wrong when they are taking 85% of all the funding 20 years later, that there is an imbalance there. And if you're not giving new voices like Dylan or others the opportunity to move into what Marxists would say, control of the means of production, it's great working for other people. I hope you've had fun working for me. Mm-hmm. But there's something to be said for owning your own company and for actually having a measure of control and also for actually owning the back end. So if the film ever does do well, if your risk pays off, you can profit down the road. So here's another daunting statistic for you. I don't want to make you cry just before WWE roadblock.
I'll probably cry during, so it's okay.
Well, only if Roman Reigns wins.
Yes.
Of that $17 million, 6% has gone to independent feature films. The other 94% have gone primarily to television and service production from away. How does that make you feel as somebody who wants to make feature films? So I'm doubling down.
Yep.
You know, less than 1% going to new filmmakers, new producers. Let's just say new producers. So less than 1% going to new producers, period. And 6% going to independent film. And the other 94% going primarily to television or service productions from away. So how does that make you feel? And I hate to put you on the spot, but you know what? These are things, when I saw these numbers, they shocked me.
Yeah.
I knew they weren't great, but I didn't know they were this bad. By the way, folks, 0.13% of the money is going to companies controlled solely by women. So as my dad used to say, put that in your pipe and smoke it too while we're thinking about this. I think these numbers need to be talked about. And I have to say that my colleagues, and I respect them, and in many cases I like them, who are in those 8 companies that have done so well for 20 years, they're not going to give up their piece of the pie willingly. It's a competitive business. So they got there for a reason. They're very competitive and they're good at it. But at some point, stagnation sets in if we don't allow people like you to have a voice. And at some point, the industry becomes unbalanced in a way it was never intended to be if 6% is going to film and 94% is going to television. So, again, I'll say, and I know I've rambled on a bit, but the more I think about it, the more important it seems to me. How does this, as a 24-year-old filmmaker, more than a television producer, make you feel? And also, what do you think maybe, do you have any ideas about maybe what could be done, what should be done?
I actually, and I won't name names or scenarios where this happened, but I had an opportunity to talk to somebody who's been in the industry for a very long time. And one of the things they said while myself and a group of people were with them was that, oh, there's no money in TV, or there's no money in movies getting TV now. Don't even worry about movies. And it immediately just, it kind of gutted me for a second, because this was somebody that, you know, and this isn't a slight on this unnamed person, but, you know, they're pretty big in the industry and they've been doing this a long time and I have the utmost respect for their work. But it was such a... just a deterrent to what I want to do as a filmmaker. And I've always been of the belief that, you know, if you have a vision, if you know what you want to do, then strive for that, work your butt off and go forward with that. In terms of changing, I honestly think that starting first off, there needs to be a change of attitude for a lot of these different situations. I know this is, you know, it's going to backlash on me, but at this point, whatever. There's a lot of clicky nature to industries, and I'm not saying everybody is, but I have seen a lot of that happen in this industry. And, you know, I wish moving forward there would be a much more open environment to doing work and an incentive for doing that work and wanting and having the ability to show that you can do this thing great and work up the ladder. A mentor of mine once told me that, you know, yeah, you can probably climb the ladder of success. Just realize that ladder's laying on the floor. And I think that's pretty, you know, apparent now. And I think it's frustrating because a lot of my peers, a lot of people that I've worked with who are just, you know, probably more passionate than I am when it comes to filmmaking, they've been trying for years and years and years and just cannot break through that glass ceiling. And it's just, they keep getting pushed down for some other reason or another. So I think first and foremost, I think there needs to be a little bit of an attitude adjustment, no wrestling pun intended, for, you know, these young filmmakers to at the very least have some sort of confidence to want to continue with what they want to do. If you keep telling somebody no, it's going to break a lot of people down. And I understand that you can't, like, not everybody can get into a festival, not everybody can get funding, that's fine. But outside of those means of showing your films and getting money for it, I just think an overall attitude of more welcoming and more allowance of different opinions and different views and different visions of movies should be, you know, a lot more welcome than it is. But that's just from my end of it, a frustrated 24-year-old film director.
Well, okay. Seeing how we're down the rabbit hole of the Paul and Dylan Stream of Consciousness Theater, where we're, you know, we probably maybe are breaking the fourth wall a little bit about some of the industry. I want to break the fourth wall one more time, and this will lead us into what to me is a much happier story. But to get to the much happier story, I want to talk about the Atlantic Film Festival. Afraid to Speak applied to the Atlantic Film Festival this year. Ron Foley McDonald reviewed it for View 902. Because you were kind enough to let us see a screening copy. As many people know, Ron is for 30 years, he was the senior programmer at the film festival. He's not anymore. But he loved it, wrote a glowing review, said that this film that you made on $3,000 or $4,000 or whatever in your credit card or your mom's credit card or whoever's credit card was really good. I watched it. I maybe saw one or two more flaws than Ron did, but I really liked it too. I absolutely... And Ron and I, as you know, have coffee almost every day at the Bedford Basin Farmers Market in the riding of Clayton Park West, where I'm running for the Progressive Conservatives in the next provincial election. I just thought I'd mention that. That's not a paid political advertisement. That's just some stream of consciousness. Not every day, but more than once a week, we still shake our heads and go, how did Afraid to Speak not get in the Atlantic Film Festival this year? Because it's a good film. It's a film made by a young filmmaker. We should be encouraging, we should be giving him a time slot. Because you'll pack the theater. The fact that it's a good film about a very important subject, which we can talk about in a minute, when we get to the happier part. It's ironic, isn't it, that I say that mental health and depression is the happier part of this conversation. Yes. But I want you to be honest. How did that make you feel?
When I first got the email, and this was the second rejection, might I add, because I submitted it a year earlier too. But I checked and made sure, like, am I still going to be able to message this or send this in? Because the film wasn't quite done the first round, and I understood that. So I was less, you know, mad the first time.
You submitted a rough cut, right?
Yes, exactly.
In a very competitive process, that can always get... So no problem the first rejection. I understand that.
Yeah.
But you submitted a finished film the second time.
Yes. And that's where I got a little more frustrated to the theme of frustration. So when I got the email, I mean, this was a film that everybody I show it to, they enjoy it. They get something out of it. Even the people that I thought would really not enjoy it, they enjoy it. And it's like, okay, cool. Maybe I have a chance here. And to preface all this too, I mean, the Atlantic Film Festival's always been a place that I've wanted to show my films. It comes back to that Atlantic pride that we kind of talked about a little bit here. You know, I want to make films here, but I also want to show films here because it is my home province. And it's there's something different about showing a film in your home province. So when I get the email that I wasn't getting in for a second time, at first I was like, well, crap, great, that kind of sucks. The thing that made me more mad and frustrated and just the whole process kind of upset me was getting to see what did get in and cross-referencing that to why I didn't get in and trying to figure it out. I'm not saying that the films that got in shouldn't have got in, because I know a lot of the filmmakers and I wish them nothing but the best careers that they can possibly have. But there were so many of these 1K films this year, and Afraid to Speak was made on about 1K, a little bit over 1K. And it was like the year of 1K, and everybody was celebrating these 1K films, and mine was the only one that didn't get in. I'm like, well, what the hell's going on? And I saw who was getting in, and it was like, oh, I know a lot of these people. I know what program they were using and all that. So short answer, I was extremely frustrated and almost saddened at the fact that I couldn't show my film. And, you know, the forefront festival in Halifax, you know, the most well-known one. But the more that I learned about the process, the more it frustrated me. And the more I realized, I think, why I didn't get in. No one in the Atlantic Film Festival or really the industry could claim my film. And what I mean by that is it wasn't part of a program. It wasn't part of an initiative. It wasn't part of anything. It was me wanting to make a story, tell a story about depression with four actors, a couple of other smaller bit actors, and a crew of maximum 4 people. But I was under no umbrella of anything. It was very frustrating to, you know, at least not get my foot in the door with that, because I've always felt like it would be so great to premiere a feature film at the Atlantic Film Festival. And we all had very high hopes. The actors, Taylor, Bob, Paige Smith, who's in Toronto now because she couldn't get work here. Everybody was really hopeful. And then just to get shut down, it was like the rug got pulled under us because we had done so much hard work to get here. I've passed by it now, and I see it more as a motivational factor for me to, you know, continue making it. I'm not going to let it kind of be the brick that knocks me out. But as a filmmaker who just wants to get his foot in the door and let people know that I'm making films and share a story that I thought was very important. Yeah, it's frustrating. It's nothing but frustrating.
You were the true independent. I saw 2 of the 5K films. I saw Nicole Steeves, which I liked, Headspace, and I saw Harmony Wagner's from Prince Edward Island, which I really liked. My film, I call it an independent film, and in the grand scheme of things it was, but you know, we had money, equity from Film and Creative Industries Nova Scotia. We had the tax credit before they blew it up. So it's independent, but it's not as independent as yours. You literally made yours with no help from anybody, except I think you had a few Indiegogo contributors, right?
Yeah, we ran through Indiegogo, and I had a couple of favors from people, but nothing like, you know, nothing that you could put down on paper.
You didn't have the institutional support. Let's put it like that.
Exactly.
And it's very hard to turn down the institutional films, and they shouldn't. All of those 1K films should have gotten in this year. Absolutely. My film should have gotten in, and it did. But your film should have gotten in, too. If we're going to celebrate the independent spirit of filmmaking, which I think we should, especially when only 6% of the money's going. I mean, if you're not going to pay them, you should at least celebrate the spirit. You know, it's not much of a victory, but I suppose it's a moral victory. You know, I really think they need to reorientate their view and put more attention to that Atlantic focus. Moving on from the depressing stuff, your film did premiere in another part of the province that starts with a P, Parsborough. So talk to us a little bit about that, and then I want to talk to you about the film, because, like I said, I really enjoyed it.
It actually had a premiere earlier than that. The Truro Film Festival last year had invited me to show the film, and the film wasn't done yet, so it was almost an unofficial premiere, but they were very nice enough to allow me the spot to have a Q&A and stuff. And so we had it there, and then just recently we had it at the Parsborough Film Festival, which was just an absolute treat to be at. And I mean, the response I've been getting, and I actually, to quote myself in an interview, which is bizarre, one of the people who were watching the film, they got what I was going for, and they admitted in the Q&A after the film that before this night, I wasn't quite sure what depression was. I didn't know what mental illness was, but this film gave me a very good idea of what it is. And then I told them, if this is the last time this film ever gets shown, then it's a success, because that's what I hope to do. So the film, being about depression, is about a guy named Nolan in his early 20s, and he has depression. But in our film, depression takes the physical manifestation of a human being, played brilliantly by Bob Mann. And we follow this, and you know, depression shows up when he's the least wanted, and Nolan has to kind of figure out a way to lessen that depression showing up. And, you know, he also has to overcome his fears of talking about what depression is. So it's a film that was inspired by, because, you know, I've been there. You know, I've been in Nolan's situation a lot of the time. And, you know, I've been told most of my career, write what you know. And this was something that I knew that I could write genuine, and it wouldn't come off as, you know, fake or someone writing this from the wrong point of view. So getting to show it, even if it's a small audience, because, I mean, the Parsborough audience wasn't big. The Truro audience was not big. But they were getting it. There were people crying. There were people laughing. I had somebody come up to me and said that they were scared, beepless, I don't know if I could swear on this, of Bob Mann's character, Sam, who is the physical manifestation of depression. And it was such an overwhelmingly awesome thing. The success that this film has had already, even in those 2 showings, has just been much more than I ever could have asked for. Because, I mean, this was a film made on $1,000. And as we kind of started this off, this random kid from Shelburne County managed to get a story together that people are enjoying and people are getting, you know, some entertainment about, but also taking on a pretty serious topic, which is mental illness. So it's been such a long ride, because making a film for 1K without that, you know, industry support that we kind of mentioned is tough. And my God, is it ever tough. But I have no regrets with how it was done. And it's just, it's been such a learning process, but it's also been such an overwhelmingly awesome, just feeling to see people see it and see people get it and enjoy it.
You talked a bit about the script, which you wrote, and sort of how the story came about out of some of your own experiences, your own backstory. Let's talk about the actors, because if I was to look and say, hey, who's a director that folks should pay attention to, and if I said Dylan Garland, one of the reasons why, or maybe the reason why, if I didn't know you from a hole in the wall, would be I watched that film, and the acting. You have Taylor Olson, who's playing the young fellow with depression. You've got Bob Mann, as you mentioned, who plays depression. You've got Paige Smith, who plays the girlfriend, the love interest. And those three form a really good triangle of really good, solid, authentic, grounded, real performances. That, to me, is the hallmark either of a very good director or somebody who got incredibly lucky. I don't think that's the case with you. So perhaps you can tell me a bit about working with those three actors,
mm-hmm.
and how you got the performances out of them, how that relationship between you and them. I told you there would be good stuff coming after all the bad stuff, because this is the kind of stuff you and I are both directors that we love talking about.
Yes.
The part about working with actors and how you get those performances, but also throw you a little curveball here. Directing actors who are bringing something new when it's your own story and your own script, that's an interesting and sometimes challenging relationship, as opposed to directing actors where you're directing a script that you didn't write.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a bit about that too, and how maybe they changed some of your own preconceived notions about your story.
You mentioned luck, and I think I got very lucky with the three of them, but there was a very long process on finding the right people to be involved in this. And Bob actually wasn't my first choice. Unfortunately, our first actor, due to some personal issues, he couldn't have the time to do it. And I had to recast, and Bob was the person that I recast. But Bob, and this isn't, again, I've mentioned this sentence a lot. There's no slight on the original actor. And we've even talked about this, me and the original actor. Bob brought something that I didn't know I needed to this film. And this kind of talks about what you mentioned about the script and actors bringing in some new stuff. There's a scene in the film where Nolan, who's played by Taylor Olson, he's contemplating suicide. And the original scene had Bob's character, who plays depression, was basically like egging him on, like, come on, do it. You're not going to do it. Go ahead, try it. And it wasn't working. And I couldn't see that because I was sitting with the script for so long and I couldn't kind of see past my own story here. And on the day, Bob came out to me and said, I have an idea. I want to run it by you. And I let him and Taylor, basically the entire script, just throw it out and improvise that entire scene. And it worked out so much better than it could have. Bob brought care to the character. And not to say that the original actor wouldn't have brought that, but Bob really wanted to make sure this character had the right motivations. The arc of the entire story, he wanted to make sure he was very careful with his character. And I had so much respect for that, because the more careful he is with his character, the better my film's going to be, because he actually cares. So Bob bringing that in was just incredible. And it was another set of eyes that hasn't been married to the script for 4 years that brought another aspect to the story. Taylor was actually not my first choice at all. Taylor Olson, and he knows this, we've had this conversation. The audition I gave him, I really didn't think I was going to cast him, because I desperately did not think that he was the right person for the role. But he came in and he did a very good audition, and he kind of changed my mind. And then the more we started talking, the more I realized, okay, you know what? You're actually perfect for this role. Taylor has kind of been there the same way I have. So he understood the background of what Nolan was going through. I mean, we had so many conversations about this. The prep time for this film was pretty much 70% just me having coffee with the actors. And that shows on the film. we would get into very deep conversations about what's going on, what happened, or how'd you feel when you went through this? How'd you feel when you went through this? And he was so motivated to make sure that we got it right and it was genuine. And Paige, and this is another kind of different angle on this. Paige has somebody she knows that has been through it. Her character in the film was kind of that character where she is, Ellie is the character's name, is seeing this from the other side of the fence and trying to figure out how to kind of cross over that fence and understand it more. And I mean, we still talk to this day. I still talk to all the actors, but me and Paige probably talk the most, and we talk about the film and the ideas that it had and all this stuff. So together, just to kind of wrap that up, together they brought different perspectives, but also they brought the care to the film that I desperately needed. Because directing a film for $1,000, I mean, I have so many hats on, it's ridiculous, but I want to focus on the story. And what allowed me to do that in the best way is that they were willing to go that extra mile and give me that performance. If they felt something was wrong, they would come to me. And the worst thing that can happen is that if an actor just, they feel something might be better, but they never bring it to me. I'm the kind of director that is collaborative. And I mean, when there's an idea that I don't like, I'll say, no, I'm not sure about that, but thanks. But I like it when people come to me with ideas that could possibly better their character. And I trusted in the three because of the so many conversations I had before we shot, and I knew where they were coming from. So I knew they weren't in it for themselves. And I knew that their intentions were pure, and it allowed me to trust them immediately with what was going on. And I will mention one more actor who unfortunately passed away recently, David Wojak, who plays the grandfather character, Bill. He brought in the older kind of generation's reaction to a lot of this, because I would argue mental illness in the understanded way that it is today is fairly recent. You know, we're kind of just breaking that wall down of understanding exactly what this is. And he actually changed one of the scenes, or proposed a change, and I said yes. That's when Nolan's very frustrated and Bill's at his house, he actually says, like, come on, you're smarter than this, snap out of it. And a lot of people resonate with that because, yeah, I mean, a bit of a stereotype with this is like, come on, you're an intelligent guy, you'll be fine. But I think it goes deeper than that. So all four of the actors brought like a completely different set of experiences to make it the best that they can. And again, when it comes to, like you mentioned, like doing a script that's written by somebody else or me, they brought the care, which gave me the trust to be able to do what I needed to do as a director. So it's just such an incredible experience. Taylor Olson, Paige Smith, Bob Mann, they're going to benefit any set that they're on. So it was probably my favorite part of the whole film, was working with them.
What you say resonates with me. I hope it would resonate with any director that's listening. And frankly, if you want to be a director, pay very close attention to what Dylan just said. And the one word that you mentioned that I believe underlines the director-actor relationship without which you can, and it's a two-way street, you cannot possibly have a good relationship, and you're probably not going to have a good film at the end of the day, is trust. And you have to build that. You can't just show up on day one of the shoot on set and say, hey, I've never met this actor before. Yep. Here's hoping we can trust each other. I remember from Exit Thread more than once that I would have conversations with the actors, in one or two cases, quite pointed conversations. You might remember one or two with Anthony Schuster, wonderful actor who played Tom Decker in my film. And, you know, we butted heads. But I think at the end of the day, we had developed a relationship of trust. I would let him have his say, and if I thought it was a good idea, we'd use it. And if I thought we should go another way, he understood that at the end of the day, it was my call. But you have to develop that relationship. And I just remember this one time, we were on location for Exit Thread, and I remember you walking up to me, and you had this sort of perplexed look on your face, and you said, hey, Paul, Robert Slade, who was one of the four main actors, he was playing the older character, Reverend Ezekiel Hart, he said, Robert wants to talk to you. And I went, oh, okay, I'm standing right here. Why are you coming up to me, Dylan? What are you, the messenger boy for Robert Slade? This isn't, who does he think he is? You know, using my assistant director as his personal assistant. And he had approached you he wanted to run an idea by me, but he was sort of not sure that I was going to be receptive to hearing the idea, because this was at a point in the shoot where he and I hadn't really worked a lot yet together on set. The end result is I talked to Robert. You brought him over, and he was like, look, I don't want to tread on your toes. And I said, I'll take any good idea right now from any source. And he actually, what he did was, like you with Taylor and Bob, he had this idea for a backstory for his character that was not in the script. So when folks see Exit Thread, and they'll see this about the scene, you know, where he sits down across from Crystal Allen's character, and he talks for about 4 minutes about his backstory. You know, this has been going on, whatever it is, folks, I don't want to give spoilers, since 1333 at the Battle of Halden Hills, blah, 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 blah. That's all him. He came up with the idea of giving this sort of supernatural backstory to the character. I said, great, I love that. I'm going to go away, do some I came up with the details, like the Battle of Halden Hill and all that. And so we kind of put it together. I never would have thought of that. And the film is richer because of his input, which he was actually a little, you know, he's such a nice guy. He just didn't want to step on anybody's toes.
Related to that, too, and it's almost, you know, now that I remembered it vividly, it's damn near shot for shot what Bob said to me after we had been done shooting. We did a bunch of interviews for some behind-the-scenes documentary stuff for the film, and during one of the questions, I asked him about the collaboration process and if it was important, and he told me that it took him 3 days to get the courage to come out to me and say, I have an idea. So it's a very interesting thing that, you know, sometimes actors are straight up scared to overstep their boundaries, but I love it when they do, because then you can establish that, oh yeah, absolutely, let's collaborate. I mean, we're in this together.
It's weird, isn't it, that we don't always see ourselves the way other people do. So you could be the dumbest person on the planet. You could be a, you know, alcoholic or complete wingnut or whatever. But if you're a director of a film, people will treat you differently. I don't think of myself that way. I'm just a guy. I don't think of you that way either. You're just a guy.
Yep.
It's because you and I know each other, I think, so well. And because when we've been on shoots together, you've been the guy that I, you know, we've taken the walks in the woods and we've just done Paul Kimball's Stream of Consciousness Theater. So you've seen me at my goofiest and my weirdest, and I've seen you at your goofiest and weirdest. And we're just a couple of fun-loving guys who are serious about our work.
Yep.
Absolutely. To think that actors would look at us. I mean, I look at the actors I'm working with and they intimidate me sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like Hillary Connell, who's an Exit Thread, multiple Best Actress Awards. I would look at her. I'd look at all of them. They were all great. But I'd look at Hillary and as she would be acting, in quotation marks, I'd go, holy crap, this girl, whew, best decision I ever made, casting her. And then, you know, Anthony would come in and I'd go, best decision I ever made was casting Anthony. They were all great. Every time they would do something, I just go, pow. I mean, do I get the credit for this? Maybe, I guess. But these guys are, I got good actors.
Yep.
There's a scene, for instance, where Crystal Allen and Anthony Schuster are acting opposite each other. And it was a scene that hadn't been working. And we rejigged it and we put the camera on the shoulders of our director of photography and we made a moving scene. And I just thought, like, they got it. Once we did that, Crystal and Anthony got it. And Crystal, boom. Just bringing the pain because she's really going after Anthony in that scene. Pow, pow, pow. Very emotional, very powerful. And Anthony, you can just see him, and this is tough for an actor to do. Sort of internalize it all and just shrink down as she's literally verbally pushing him into a chair, and then there's a big revelation, and boom. And a scene that I thought, this scene might not work. By the end of the evening, working with Ken LeBlanc, our great director of photography, but also working with Crystal and Anthony, these two wonderful actors, to really bring this scene out and to give them the opportunity to bring what they had inside to the film. Absolutely amazing. There's nothing more gratifying as a director. It just makes you feel like you're doing something right. And you're doing something right because you're trusting people that you're working with in their talent, in their commitment, in their belief, in their craft.
Yep.
I don't know if you've ever done this, but as a director, sometimes you just go, cut. Hey, that was good, folks. That was good, folks. Hey, let's just take five, and everybody wanders off to where they're going to go, and you walk into the bathroom or in a corner or outside by yourself somewhere, and you just go, yes, 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 yes. You know, wow, I'm not any good,
yep,
but I've hired good people, and they are going to make me look good. You know, and then you go back and you go, all right, is everybody ready? Of course, that was a good take. Let's try it again. Yes.
You get a hold of the director demeanor. And it's funny because what Bob felt about me, I felt about Bob. Because, you know, when you're young and you're directing, and Bob's not old by any means, but, you know, older people, there's always that kind of disconnect, like, well, I don't know how I'm going to seem as this young person directing this film. But the second we broke through that, it's like it was awesome. And I had those moments with Bob every time I shot a scene and he would do this thing. The cafe scene between Nolan and Bob when he first shows up in the film, I had that moment because Bob's delivery was just so quick and so on, and it was fantastic. And then you got to walk away and say, yeah, just take five, freak out, come back, get your composure going, and it's fine. I actually would say I'm at my best when, you know, the actors are bringing that out of me. Because if I'm working with an actor who shows up and just wants to be, you know, stubborn, it's tough to break through that. And I think, you know, the word of the day here, trust between two people is great. And I mean, me and you work like that, too. We've done, like you said, four films together. So when I'm first assistant directing your film and I hear you say, yep, Dylan's coming, I'll drive Dylan home tonight, I know exactly what's going to happen. And I think we get through that fairly well. So, yeah, trust.
Yeah, I'm going to drop you off at Peggy's Cove and say, hey, look, can you run in and get me a Diet Coke? And then I'm going to leave you there. That's what's going to happen. Oh, wait, that wasn't
that
you.
Was the first AD.
Yeah, that, exactly. Funny, Dylan mentions these actors weren't his first choice. Well, Dylan wasn't my first choice either. But unfortunately, there was an incident in Peggy's Cove with a Diet Coke and a rabid seal. Didn't end well. I'm not criminally liable, but I still feel some sense of responsibility for what happened there.
Oh, man.
Anyway. It's one of the tragic untold stories of Peggy's Cove. So changing tack just a little bit, one last time, and then we both have to go watch wrestling. You've done a number of music videos. I like to take some teeny tiny small amount of credit for that because I introduced you to John Mulane, for whom you've done a number of award-winning music videos.
Yep.
And one of the things, although I like 0.2%. That's the credit I get, which is basically more or less around the same percentage of funding that goes to companies controlled by women in this province. So, I know how they feel now. Perfect. I want to ask you, which one of them is your favorite music video? Not which one is your favorite artist, not which one of them is your favorite song, but which one as a director do you think you did the best job on, that was the most creative, that you really sort of worked well with the band? It all came together. Which one do you hold sort of first and foremost in your heart, and why?
I got to give it to the Town Heroes Holding Up Grants, and that's the one that we won two awards for. We got the East Coast Music Award and the Nova Scotia Music Award. It was just, and I look back now because I've done some cinematography in the past little bit, but I've done more directing. But for that video, I shot and directed it, and it was the first video that I actually had a bit of funding for. And that didn't change my view on it, but it allowed us to go out there and we went up to Cape Breton for 3 days. We just had the time of our lives. And coming back to what we talked about with the actors, the trust thing, at that point, I think it was my third or fourth video for them. So they trusted me and they allowed me to direct them and to take them places and just to go out there and film the absolute best footage we could to showcase this beautiful part of the country, being Cape Breton. And we just had such a fun time with it. So that always has, I think, the top spot in my heart, as cheesy as that is to say. So Holding Up Grants to Town Heroes. On the creative side, I've always enjoyed the Stanfield's Hard Miles video, which is a bit of a camera trickery where they're on a long, winding dirt road. And we make it seem like the band keeps reappearing at the end of the line. We're kind of going through them as a straight line, kind of figurating it in between them. And it was a concept that when I wrote it down on this very crude, I just had a piece of printer paper and I used a marker to crudely draw it out and I emailed it to them. They were like, cool. I didn't think it would work as well as it was going to. And I had a lot of doubts and worries, but we just had a fantastic crew and the band was super cool with going way over time than I had originally planned. And it was just a creative idea that turned out really well. So I'd say Holding Up Grants. If I had to give you a hard answer, it'd be Holding Up Grants by the Town Heroes.
I'll say two things. First of all, clearly you've learned your storyboarding technique from me. The second thing that I take out of all of that is that while your Town Heroes video, Holding Up Grants, is your personal favorite, I love the Stanfields video because I had never heard of the Stanfields before until I saw your video. And I said, that's an awesome video. And that's a really, really good song, too.
Yep.
So Holding Up Grants is your favorite song, which leads me to my final Bill Clinton pivot, if you will, because we've been holding ourselves up from getting to WWE Roadblock, which is going to be the most awesome wrestling pay-per-view tonight. High praise indeed. So we're Dylan and I, and we're in different places. We're in different geographic locations. Dylan right now is shooting a film in Australia, and I am here in the Yukon shooting a film. I don't know who arranged this for the two of us, but clearly Dylan's got the better. Oh my God, Dylan, is that a poisonous snake I see? Well, folks, that's it for Dylan Garland, who was one of our most promising young filmmakers in Nova Scotia, but is now, sadly, been bitten by a poisonous snake in Australia. I personally blame Andrew Mark Sewell for this.
It was the damn space otters.
Right. Exactly. Dylan Garland has been abducted by space otters. No, seriously, it is... Wait, I was being serious. How do they get the helmets on their heads? I don't understand. How do they breathe in space? And on that note, with a reference to telepathic space otters, I joke that he is the son I will never have. But I have to say, because I've known him since he was a teeny tiny little sprog, this kid over the last 8 years that I've known him has done wonderful, wonderful work. He's not a kid. He's a young man now. If Nova Scotia's film industry is going to have a future, Dylan Garland is going to be at the forefront of it. And hopefully, and this is not me blaming the McNeil government, this is as much on the film industry as it is on the McNeil government. Hopefully, we can construct a system of funding and of support in this province that allows talented young filmmakers like Dylan not only to stay, but to flourish, to tell independent stories that can resonate and sell around the world. But the number of young filmmakers, or old filmmakers for that matter, that can actually make an impact beyond our borders is smaller than it's ever been. And we need to figure out a way to change that. Dylan Garland is going to be in the vanguard of that, assuming he's still living here and that folks in Toronto or somewhere in the United States haven't cottoned on to his talent and snapped him up from us before we have a chance to fix the system. So I am incredibly proud of the young man that you've become, Dylan. You are a fine, fine filmmaker, and you're just going to get better and better as the years go along.
Well, I really appreciate that. It means a lot. And you know, it all started with you saying yes to me, just, you know, kind of watching Eternal Kiss. So it allowed me a lot. And I will mention this, because you mentioned that I'm the Anakin to your Obi-Wan. After seeing Rogue One, you better be scared of that analogy.
Well, so long as it isn't something like Luke kissing Leia, and then we find out later that Leia's actually Luke's sister, which was, in hindsight, really creepy, then I'm fine with it. So bring it on, Anakin. Bring it on. Thanks for tuning in, folks. My guest tonight has been my good friend Dylan Garland, one of Nova Scotia's up-and-coming, super young filmmakers. If you get a chance to see his film Afraid to Speak, I can't recommend it highly enough. Also, check out his music videos. I'll post a couple of them here on the site. This has been the View 902 podcast, and here are the Stanfields with Hard Miles.
She goes on a western run. You turned her back to the rising sun. You just fueled up and the weather looks good and the game is on. May the lines no longer pass you by. Hard miles taking you from your prize. Hard miles. You're bouncing around like a loose pinball. You're thinking too much about nothing at all. But you miss your bed and you miss your girl and your ways from home. May the lines no longer pass you by. Hard miles taking you. Enterprise, hard miles. Mr. Man, your day is done. You strain your eyes on the setting sun, but you count your blessings and look forward to another night alone. Who made the lines no longer pass you by? Hard miles taking you from your prize.